Hello, I hope you've had a good week wherever you're listening from. Thanks for tuning in to the True Travel Podcast with me, Laura Sanders. My guest this week will be providing you with a healthy dose of armchair travel as she tells us about her world first expedition through the depths of the Amazon jungle. Pip Stewart is an author, journalist and adventurer from the UK who, just before the pandemic, embarked upon a three-month voyage following the Essequibo River in Guyana from source to sea. Pip hiked, kayaked and hacked her way through the dense, unexplored forest along with two friends and five members of the YY Indigenous community. They went through with this expedition knowing that if they got into trouble, there was no guarantee that help could reach them. Pip faced deadly snakes, jaguars, and worst of all, a flesh-eating parasite, which she'll be providing all of the gory details of in this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, remember to hit subscribe so you'll know when new episodes are released, and you can head over to the podcast's social media pages to see more from Pip's adventures. Hi, Pip. It's lovely to finally meet you and catch up. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Laura. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
Yeah, no, it's great to have you, and I'm looking forward to hearing more about this epic adventure you did through the Amazon. I'm headed that way myself this year, but nowhere near as deep into the forest as you went. It sounds incredible. So I'm going to Peru, and I'm going to stay in the Amazon, but I'll be in a nice little jungle lodge for a few days. I won't be putting up tents and dealing with flesh-eating parasites like you did. So
hopefully not, but that sounds incredible.
Yeah, really exciting. I'm looking forward to it. So let's move on to you then. First of all, just tell me a bit about yourself. We'll get on to this big adventure later, but you know, were you always into these big adventures?
Yeah, so I'm an author, and yeah, I've always loved travel. I guess my dad was in the forces, so as a kid I was carted from place to place, like a very peripatetic upbringing, like always moving. So I think it was just sort of in the genes, in a sense. It's like, yeah, I think anyone who likes travel has that sense of itchy feet.
Yeah, totally understand where you're coming from with that. Same here. That's great. So let's talk a bit about this expedition. Let's dive right in. So a few years ago, you decided, or your friend actually phoned you up, didn't she? She suggested this huge expedition through the Amazon. You were following the, and excuse my pronunciation, the Essequibo River.
Perfect. Yep, nailed it.
Brilliant. From source to sea through Guyana. And you had to ask permission of a tribe there, didn't you, to do this expedition. There was a lot put in place to be able to just get there, and it was 3 months going through the jungle. You faced all sorts of challenges, and you've written a book about it. And yeah, just tell me how it all came to happen. What made you say yes?
So I'm sure everyone's got a mate that gets them into trouble, and I loosely knew this woman at the time called Laura Bingham, and I've come across her at a campfire festival, which is like an adventure festival basically. And we bonded over her baby's dirty nappy. So she essentially said, do you mind giving me a hand changing my dirty nappy? My baby's dirty nappy, not hers. And I was like, yeah, fine. And I think that sort of qualified me for a place on her expedition, because she'd been planning a world first, as you say, source to sea descent to the Essequibo River in Guyana. It's a 1,000-kilometer river. There's rapids, there's waterfalls. It's in the Guiana Shield, which is part of the larger Amazon biome. And at the time, I think, Laura, I was, you know, Red Bull's adventure editor. And a bit like you might find with your day job, you spend a lot of time writing about adventures and trips. And then you kind of, it sort of inspires you to do your own. And I think I'd got to the point where, maybe having been sat at a desk for too long, I got a call one afternoon, that point around, you know, your mid-afternoon slump, when Laura rang me up and was like, how do you feel about doing this expedition? And essentially I said, yes, this is despite having kayaked only once before and found it like the most painful sport ever. I was like, why does anyone do this? You know, my shoulders hurt, my everything hurt. I was just like, this is not for me. But I agreed to say yes, and ended up training for 6 to 8 months before we set off, learning how to kayak in Wales on the River Dee. And yeah, we set off. And as you said at the beginning, we did this trip in conjunction with the YY Indigenous community. We had to get permission from the community. We had to get permission from the Ministry of Indigenous Affairs. And the First Lady of Guyana, Sandra Granger at the time, she was a patron of our expedition as well. So it was very much a multinational expedition, and one that I would not be alive if it weren't for my teammates.
So you essentially bonded over babies, and then you know, took off for 3 minutes through the jungle. That's fantastic. So talked a little bit about what was involved in getting there. Just elaborate on that. I imagine there was loads of paperwork and loads of vaccinations and all sorts of things that people don't realise.
Yeah, well, I mean, hats off to Laura, because at the time her son Ran was about 6 months old, and having now had a baby myself, I'm like, how on earth did she pull together an expedition that involved essentially getting all the relevant permission on the ground in Guyana? We did have a fixer who helped us on the ground, but then also just a risk assessment. You know, you're looking, we didn't blithely go off with kind of no clue about what we were doing. You know, we had to be really informed about the risks that we were taking. We skilled ourselves up, like physically, we had to kind of really train really hard. And the adventure community is amazing, because once we said, this is what we're planning on doing, people opened their hearts and their minds to us. And they were like, look, we'll help you with the mapping. We can help you with the fitness. This is come train with us. And it was amazing just to see the support and the help that we received. But not only that, you know, getting an expedition like this off the ground, Laura was fundraising. She was trying to find sponsors. And I have done expeditions before, but a lot smaller in scale. So, you know, I'd cycled back from Malaysia, where I was working as a journalist, back to London. But that was sort of, you know, me and my partner, we just took off on the bike, and every day you just get up and you cycle and eventually you're there. We didn't have any sponsors or anything like that. It was a very simple journey in many respects.
I love how you call that a simple journey in a smaller expedition. To me, that still sounds pretty big.
Well, the thing is, though, it's like if you can go to your office and sit at a desk from 9 to 5, you can sit on a bicycle. And in so many ways, I think that's what appeals about expedition, is because it's just wonderfully simple, because your day is about waking up, surviving and getting from A to B. And a lot of the pressures of, you know, day-to-day life are kind of removed. So, you know, when I started that cycle trip, we hadn't done much training at all. I was very unfit. The first couple of days I was like, what have I done? This is a disaster. I'm not fit enough. And then slowly you realize that by just putting in that little bit each day, you get somewhere. And okay, it took us 13 months to cycle 10,000 miles. And my partner, Charlie, he's more of an athlete. He probably could have done it in 6. But, you know, we got there and we saw things. And I think so often we're scared of those big hairy goals, aren't we? But if you break them up into, it sounds cliche, but if you break it up into smaller chunks, suddenly you look back over the course of a year and you're like, whoa, we cycled halfway around the world. How did that happen? I was so unfit, and now I'm cycling up mountains. So yeah, I think it is possible.
That's amazing. I mean, just that adventure itself, it sounds like you would have seen so much, and you'd have seen the landscape change and the cultures change as you went through. So that in itself sounds incredible. I'm very jealous. But yes, back onto the Amazon expedition. You're saying there's a lot involved in that and the training as well. But yeah, you did it. You got there. So talk me through day one. What was it like? Did you get there and think, oh my God, what the heck have I done? Or were you excited? Or I imagine a little bit of both.
I was just a mess, to be honest, Laura, because, you know, unlike other trips I've done, I've been to the Amazon before because I filmed a documentary with a friend of mine called Reza Pakravan looking at deforestation. But that was sort of cycling along a road called the Trans-Amazonian Highway. And we knew that, you know, we were on a road essentially, and we were looking at deforestation from that perspective. This was the first time we probably embraced wilderness. 500 people or something had been in space, and hardly anyone has been where we were going. And it was really, really scary. It felt like I'd been put in a washing machine and tumbled around. And, you know, in the lead up to the trip, I was having nightmares because this was the first time I'd really left the safety of community. You know, we'd met on day one in Guyana. We arrived in Georgetown, the capital. And we went to go and see the helicopter rescue people. And they said, look, where you're going is so remote. You know, there is a possibility of rescue, but we've got a few problems. Number one, we don't fly at night, so don't get into trouble after 3 p.m. Number two, we don't have a winch system. And number three, bear in mind that you're in dense rainforest and helicopter blades need enough space to land. So given that we were hiking to the source of a river, and you can imagine as the water sort of dries up as you go further upstream, the canopy encloses as well. So in short, we were stuffed if something went wrong on that hike to the source. And I remember we flew from Georgetown to Masakanara, which is the village it's a YY indigenous community. It's a protected area. And we landed on this airstrip in the middle of the jungle. And I was struck with like, whoa, okay, this, you know, you fly over this vast expanse of pristine wilderness and you're like, we're going to be wandering around in there trying to find the source of this amazingly massive, vast river that we saw at Georgetown, you know, 32 kilometers at its largest stretch. And yet we're finding this kind of tiny trickle of where it originates. And yeah, I was really scared. I'm not going to lie, because it's quite a big thing. And I think so much of that was realizing that on a day-to-day basis, you know, we were going to be putting our lives at risk. There were snakes, spiders, scorpions, rapids, waterfalls, and I'm exceptionally clumsy. So I was like, this doesn't bode well, does it?
No, you sound a little bit like me. I'm very clumsy. I always end up, you know, being the one having the accident. So I can relate to you there.
Yeah,
I can imagine, you know, a lot of the time you have these big trips planned and you imagine them for months. And when you get there, you think, oh, this is real. Oh my gosh, what am I doing? But it can be equally as thrilling. You know, you hear that saying all the time, don't you? Feel the fear and do it anyway. And I think that's pretty much what you did, wasn't it?
Yeah, but to a point though, Laura, I think this was the first trip where I felt like I've gone too far. Like I could die here. And that was a scary thing to think. We had five guides from the YY, Nereus, Jackson, Aaron, Semsi and Nigel joined us on the hike to the source. So we were in good hands, but still, you know, I nearly sat on a deadly snake at one point. Suddenly I heard from behind me, Laura go, oh my goodness, there's a snake. And I'd got my foot essentially stuck between a log and a vine. I was wiggling it around, trying to get it free. And 2 inches under my bum was something called the fur de lance, which is like known for its fast, swift and deadly attacks. And I'm thinking, I'm in a bit of trouble here. Luckily, Jackson appeared over me and macheted it to death. And, you know, I just stared at Jackson and I said, Jackson, why did you kill the snake? And he said, well, Pip, if I didn't kill the snake, it would have killed you. And I think mentally that really took a toll because, you know, like I said, we were weeks away from medical help. At that point, I was waking up with nightmares, like literal night terrors, screaming, waking up the entire camp, thinking, God, what, you know, my ego essentially has brought me to this point to want to do a world first expedition. Life at home is lovely. What am I doing? And obviously that feeling and thought changed as the expedition went on. But I think when anyone struggles, when you're in that moment, it's really scary when you're kind of stuck with your own thoughts. And I think it was at that point that I realized, you know, I couldn't change my situation. I could just change my attitude because I was stuck. I was literally stuck in the jungle, but kind of opening up to my teammate, saying that I really was struggling. People would give me a cuddle in the middle of the night if I was stressing out, or a fire would appear next to the hammock where there hadn't been one before. And I think it's remarkable how humans can adapt, because by the end of that journey, I came to love being in the jungle and in my hammock at night. But after that particular incident, it was absolutely terrifying. And you're going to bed thinking, am I going to get attacked by a jaguar? What happens if there's a flash flood? You know, all these things about what could go wrong. And it's just trying to quieten those kind of negative, critical thoughts, isn't it?
Yeah. And I guess a realization of how small and insignificant we humans are. Really, when you're really out there in nature, I mean, most of the time we're safe in our houses.
Yeah,
we get to the park, that's our bit of nature, but to really be up against nature, yes, it must have been very, very frightening.
It was, but it was also amazingly freeing, because you realize, yeah, do you know what, we are a tiny speck. When you're standing next to a tree, goodness knows how many thousands of years old, you're like, whoa, we are so small in this world. And there's something really freeing about that, kind of not taking yourself so seriously and not taking up like the problems and things. So it was that weird one where it's an environment where I've never felt more on edge, yet I've never felt more alive.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that comes through in your book, which is called Life Lessons from the Amazon. It's very much about, you know, learning to be patient, learning to accept things, learning to appreciate the little things. All these sort of life lessons you learned from those really tough times really come through in the book. Which is fantastic. So just tell me a little bit about some of the other challenges you face. And obviously the big one is a flesh-eating parasite. At what point did that come about in the expedition?
Yeah, so, I mean, as you'll find out, Laura, when you head off to Peru, and yeah, anyone who's been in a rainforest or jungle environment will know, like, you are just covered in bites, and that there is that element of discomfort that you just have to accept in a place that's teeming with life. So yeah, I was full of bites and things, and obviously I was trying my best to protect myself, wearing long sleeve clothing, insect repellent infused, that kind of thing. But yeah, I came back after the journey thinking, okay, we've survived the rapids, the snakes, the spiders, all of that, the caiman that paddled past our like inflatable kayaks. But I came back with this kind of mark on my neck. I was like, that's really strange. And it was this bite. And then it kind of scabbed over and I'm like, okay, maybe it's just got infected. And then it kind of hollowed out and it got into this weird pussy hollowing out dance. And eventually I thought, well, I'll go to the Hospital for Tropical Diseases in London because they have a walk-in clinic, an amazing place actually, if anyone's coming back from travels and worried about something. And I saw Professor Chris Whitty. He wasn't quite as famous then, but
he, no way.
He was the guy I saw. And he said, I'm going to refer you to my colleague, Dr. Steve Walker, who's a dermatologist, because I think you've got something called leishmaniasis. I'm like, okay, what's leishmaniasis? And essentially, it's a flesh-eating parasite. And being kind of given that diagnosis was absolutely terrifying because I don't know if anyone else goes on Google when you go to the doctors and you're like, what was that they said? And then you're like, oh my goodness. Google is never your friend, is it? When you've got
a headache.
And you're like, oh, that's it. I'm on my way out. but leishmaniasis was terrifying because you suddenly see pictures of people missing their face. And that was what I was told, that unless I had a form of chemotherapy that's really outdated from the 1940s, because treatment options are severely limited, the parasite risks spreading to my nose and my soft palate. So essentially it could eat my face. And so, you know, I'd come back. Laura, I'm not an athlete, as I said, but I had a six pack. I was in the best shape I've ever been. And then after 3 weeks on an IV being pumped full of a highly toxic medicine that, you know, the doctors monitoring my heart and my liver in case they packed up. And yeah, I could barely walk by the end of this treatment. And the funniest thing about it is, well, it's not funny at all, is it's like the second biggest parasitic killer after malaria. But there's not much done about it because most people who get it, even though it's in 98 countries and 1 billion people are at risk from it, is because the people who get it are poor and live in remote areas. So at this point, I messaged someone I met on the journey, a woman called Faye, and I said, have you heard of leishmaniasis? You know, what have you done to cure it if you've heard of it? And she said, yeah, do you remember those scars I had on my leg pit? That was leish. And she said, I put boiling cow fat onto my skin to like sear out the parasite. And I'm thinking, you know, in the 21st century, how are treatment options, boiling cow fat, which incidentally might actually work, it's just there's not been that much research into heat treatment, or outdated chemotherapy. So it was one of those things, Laura, where, you know, life throws some weird stuff at you, doesn't it? And it's not always good. But I was determined to try and think, okay, so I can't, again, I can't change the situation. Like, what can I do? And I think that's something that has really helped me actually on that journey, trying to kind of get around it mentally, is to think, okay, well, I can raise awareness of this disease. I can make people aware of neglected diseases and the inherent like injustice around them. So yeah, that was a shocker, shall we say, coming back from the trip.
Yeah, just a bit. I should think your family and your partner were so worried about you as well. So how long were you being treated for? And did you have the chemotherapy and then it just went, or did it have to be pulled out, or?
No, so the weird thing about it is it basically encourages your body to attack itself. And so after 3 weeks, see the scar, the hole in my neck was closing up, but they never know if it's gone for good. That's a problem. So I'm constantly on edge. If I feel like a lump in my nose, or if I had some lumps in the back of my throat, actually, while I was writing this book, and I went to go and see a specialist, and he was like, no, I don't think it's a leishmaniasis. It's a mucus cyst. I'm like, oh, I'll take a mucus cyst. You know, I don't know what that is, but I'll take it over a flesh-eating parasite. So no, it's one of those things that it could just crop back at any time. So hopefully it's gone, but we just don't know.
Yeah, fingers crossed for you. So that was probably definitely your biggest challenge, wasn't it?
Yeah.
For sure. Tell me about some of the highlights. I feel like we've spoken about how difficult this was, and of course it was difficult, but of course you've loved it and you've got some more highlights. Tell me about some of those.
Oh my God. No, I mean, first up, it was just the team dynamic. You know, when you spend time on expedition or traveling with anyone, of course you're going to get on each other's nerves a little bit because that's just life. But ultimately, it was just amazing. And you know, the privilege of spending time with people from the YY community and sharing knowledge and hearing stories was amazing. And then just the friendships that formed. And as I say, the wildlife was phenomenal. You know, you're kayaking along and you'll see these unbelievable macaws flying through the jungle, or a group of capuchin monkeys suddenly decided, like with their babies, to jump across the river at one point. And we're watching them like jump when the river was narrow, obviously jumping from tree to tree and waking up with that prehistoric roar of the howler monkey, or lying in your hammock at night, just listening to the rain on the tarp sort of pitter pattering. And Jackson, one of our guides, every morning at 5 o'clock in the morning, as dawn is breaking through the jungle, he would start singing. And it was just his beautiful wake up call every morning. And yeah, I think it's those moments of just feeling really immersed in nature, that kind of not having the pressure of checking your phone or checking WhatsApp or like all these constant things that we buzz ourselves with day in, day out, and just being as present as we could be. And I think that was the joy of this journey, is that yes, it was life threatening, but it also brought into sharp focus just how amazing life is. Because you're like, I've survived another day, hallelujah, this is awesome. So yeah, it was that kind of dichotomy between life and death, and that kind of just realizing that life is so fragile and so beautiful.
Absolutely. Tell me a little bit more about the Weiwei community then, because obviously your guides were from that community. They must have known that jungle better than anybody. How did they feel about you doing this expedition through it?
Yeah, so it was amazing. So as we arrived in the YY community, we had to basically have the entire village came out to see who we were. And Nigel was the youngest member of our team. He was 16. And as we got off the plane, he kind of met us to help us with some bags and the luggage and things. And he was like, oh, I heard there were some people coming to kayak the Essequibo, but I thought you'd all be men. I'm quite surprised that you're three women. And so then we got taken from the plane to the community. It's called a Benab. It's this roundhouse covered in palm. And it's just beautiful. And everyone turned out, and essentially we were there to explain what we were doing and to ask for the community's help. It had all been agreed beforehand, but before it could actually go ahead, we had to have the buy-in from the whole community. So that was a really nice opportunity to sort of meet everybody and meet our guides who are going to guide us. It was agreed that the expedition could go ahead, but we were asked, could you, you know, stay a couple of days beforehand, do some teaching in the school? And then it was agreed that after church on Sunday, the expedition would begin. And it was really interesting, actually, the religious aspect of the journey, because of the missionary history in the Amazon, the YY are very Christian. And it was something that came through on expedition as well. You know, every time before we'd eat, grace would be said, songs were sung about Jesus in his canoe. And it was interesting, because I'm not a religious person. I would love to have a faith. But it was great to sort of be around that that faith, in a sense. And it made me think about things differently. And it kind of made me think, maybe. So it shifted the dial a little bit for me. But it was just the most incredible opportunity and privilege to spend time with people from the YY community. And something that was really important for us is that neither Ness, Laura, or I, you know, we're not cartographers. We don't know where the source of a river was. So we said to the community, look, we would like you to take us to where you think the source of the river is. So it was very much a YY-led trip to the source. And it was great getting everyone's kind of feedback when we finally made it. It's high up in the Akari Mountains. You know, we're talking 45 degree slopes. We're hiking up, like a good day of movement is 4 kilometers. We're hacking our way with a machete. And when we get there, you know, Sempsi and Jackson said to me, we're just so honored, you know, we were chosen by our community to lead this expedition. No one has stood on this spot, you know, more people have been in space. And we as YY people did it. And that was amazing to kind of hear and share that experience.
That's incredible. It sounds like you had a really unique insight into that community, really privileged, as you say, to be able to be there and to witness day-to-day life and to have their blessing to do it, which is great. And I know, you know, Indigenous tourism is beginning to be a bit of a buzzword, isn't it, in travel. You know, you should go and interact with these communities and they can lead tours and teach you about their way of life and stuff like that. But do you feel as though these Indigenous communities are at threat at all? Or
yeah, it's an interesting one. And I think it's, as you say, the concept of tourism to Indigenous places is inherently problematic because it does open up a whole range of ethical questions. Of which, you know, in the past, I haven't necessarily been that attentive to. And it was something that on this journey, I really started to think harder about. But I think talking to people, it's interesting because the internet has enabled so much. I mean, in order to get permission for this trip, we're talking to people on Facebook. And the way that the YY community earn money, I mean, it's very much a subsistence farming community as well. But you know, people will go and do gold mining, guiding trips like ours. And quite a lot of the young people do see from Facebook and Instagram and things like that, life in Georgetown and life in other places. And there is definitely a problem that the younger generation maybe don't want to stay in the village and the heritage and the culture. That being said, I do think it's very hard as an outsider to say what's right or wrong for a community. And I think ultimately, a community has to decide for itself the benefits of openness. And that's why I think as a tourist to these places, it's really important to check that you're wanted in a place, that you're not kind of, I'm quite skeptical quite often of big tour companies that aren't locally operated because I'm like, who's getting the money? Who's benefiting from this? So I think as tourists, it's a tricky one. It's ethically, you know, I think we need to do a bit more thinking around this issue.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you've hit the nail on the head there with that one. It was a tough question, but you answered it well. So what surprised you the most about this entire expedition?
How much travel has the power to change? I think, you know, having done expeditions before and things like that, I was like, oh, great. You know, it's another trip and I'll come and do it and it'll be great and it'll be fun and it'll be interesting. And I think what's beautiful about adventure is it's like life, you know, it's not always fun and it pushes you to each corner of yourself, the light and the dark in all of us. And, you know, we had 3 months on this journey. It's a lot of time as well, sat in a kayak, just paddling on my own. So a lot of time for reflection. And I started to see the downside of travel a little bit and how actually maybe me traveling places isn't necessarily always helpful. And so I guess it was just a lot of time of self-reflection and yeah, just time to think really. And it's different. I feel like a different woman from when I set off, definitely.
That's interesting you say you started to think about the downsides of travel and how it's not always helpful. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I was listening to your interview this week with Helen, who's doing all the kind of no flight stuff. And I thought that was really fascinating because there's the environmental impact, there's a human impact. And I think what I love about travel is the ability to connect and humans' connection and all of that. But I think there is a sort of a darker side to travel, which hasn't been talked about enough. As you say, it's like Indigenous tourism. It's the environmental impact. It's, you know, putting yourself into a culture that maybe doesn't want you there, or like even just who are we taking photos of? Do people want photos being taken of them? I mean, would you like a photo being taken when you're just having a cup of tea? Probably not.
It's a huge one, that, isn't it? I often think that thing, if I was walking around London and somebody just came and took a photo of me, would I like it?
Yeah. And I think people in the global north, you know, we do have the privilege to travel. And I just think quite often it's become about like ticking off how many countries, and it's not necessary. You can't do a country, I don't think. It's like unless you live there, you can't say, oh, I've done this, I've done that. Whereas, I don't know, I think, as I say, I think it's problematic.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point there. One that I've considered myself as well. And you often think this is a very privileged thing to be able to do. How can we make sure that we're giving back as well? Would you do this again?
Do you know what? In some ways, I'm going to throw the question back at you, Laura, and say, would you give up the best experiences of your life if it meant you never had to experience the worst? You know, I had the best time I possibly ever had in terms of just feeling alive and in a natural environment. But there were some major downsides as well. So And also now I've become a mum, which has massively changed things. So I don't know, would I do it again? Probably nothing this extreme. I think it was definitely over my comfort zone limits. But yeah, definitely the travel, definitely kind of that sense of adventure. But I think also the days of doing world firsts or things to be able to say, you know, I've done this, I've cycled halfway around the world, or I've done a world first expedition. I'm now equally happy to say, yeah, I stared at stones on a beach for half an hour and that was blooming marvelous. Like, they're so beautiful. And that's sort of part of how this trip has changed me, is actually, you know, we don't need to do these grand journeys. It's so much of it is like finding comfort and just feeling more solid in yourself necessarily. I think travel, people who love to travel, I think either are running from something or running to something. And I feel a little bit more grounded in myself now. And I still want to travel, but for maybe different reasons.
You touched a little bit on mental health there and travel. And of course, one of the earliest episodes of this podcast was talking to someone about mental health. You know, are we running away from problems by just running around the world, or are we running to something? So it's interesting that you've thought that as well. And yes, something does change in you when you traveled. You know, I went away, did the typical backpacking after university for 5 weeks from Southeast Asia and felt an entirely different person when I got home. But it does change something in you. It makes you independent. It makes you realize how small your problems are compared to someone else, and all of these things. And of course, becoming a mother as well must have changed your perspective. I mean, you must think a lot more about the dangers now. You know, you have an extra person that you could possibly leave behind if something happened, if the worst happened, touch wood. So yeah, it's almost as if you're saying that this expedition was the peak, if you like, not saying that anything after that's going
that's
to
it,
be
I'm done.
Not
I'm
as
peaked.
Good. Yeah, you peaked.
It's depressing, isn't it? Girl.
Not at all.
No, I know what you mean. And what was amazing was that Laura had, as I said, she had a 6-month-old when we set off, and I saw the anguish that she went through. So I'm very keen, having seen how Laura struggled with it. I think she, speaking to her since, she wouldn't mind me saying, I'm not sure she would do it with again like that either. So yeah, it's an interesting beast, the world of adventure.
It is, isn't it? So tell me how it felt getting to the very end of it. What was your final walk, your final day like? Describe the atmosphere, describe how you felt.
Oh, well, it was glorious, Laura. So essentially we had a major headwind. And I remember seeing this pink building sort of near the Atlantic Ocean. We were finishing a couple of kilometers down from that. But for about an hour, this blooming pink building was still on my right-hand side because of the headwind and the waves. You know, I felt like we were making no headway. I'm a big fan of mantra, and something that kept going through my head was, you can do this, you are doing this. You can do this, you are doing this. So I was trying to like paddle in time with that little mantra. And ultimately we ended up getting there. But there, i.e. the finish line, was sort of this concrete bank just by a shrimp processing factory. Our fixer Sophia had tried to like put up a banner to say welcome back sort of thing, but that had disintegrated and like blown into the sea. We then climb out and we've got some of the Guyanese media like lined up behind the bank to take photos. I get out my kayak. I said I'm very clumsy. I slipped. My paddle landed and clonked me on the head. I'm like half in, half out the water, just absolutely drenched in front of all the media.
Oh no.
And it was just bizarre. And then we had this amazing team cuddle. And I think that for me was a highlight, when you're looking at your teammates going, oh my goodness, you know, we've seen the source of this river, this tiny spring up in the mountains, and we've lived and breathed the river. We've seen the communities that call it home. We've passed gold mining areas. We've seen the most incredible wildlife. And now we've been kicked out into the Atlantic Ocean and we're here. And sort of being under their sweaty armpits and we all stank of vinegar, just hopping up and down was amazing. And it's one of those things, isn't it, where I think when you have a big goal and you reach it, sometimes there's this feeling of just a bit, okay, and now we're done. And I remember we packed up the kayaks and we put them in the back of a taxi, and I hadn't seen cars for so long. And we drove past a graveyard that had been flooded. So it was flooded with water, and above it was a billboard advertising something. And I found that disconnect between life in the jungle where we felt so alive, and then suddenly seeing the reality of urban life, you know, the consumerism, and then the juxtaposition next to the graveyard. I'm like, oh my God, like life is short and for living. Then we ended up in the hotel. We thought we were going to have a celebration there, but everyone had buggered off home. And our celebratory dinner was a peanut butter sandwich. And then Laura flew home the next day to go and see her baby. And Ness and I went back to the YY community to say goodbye. So it was an interesting kind of finish. And I think one of the things that I take in life is that, you know, we have ups and we have downs, don't we? And I think it's that gap between expectation and reality that can lead to us feeling like things are wrong or something's off. And so, yeah, I actually loved the way the expedition ended, because I'm like, yeah, that's life. You do a world first expedition, you fall in the water, your paddle clonks you on your head, and you have an amazing cuddle with your teammates. You know, it's not all good. It's not all bad.
It's not quite the heroic, you know, peering out of the jungle that you would imagine, falling in the river and clonking yourself in the head.
Yeah, it's no Lara Croft.
Certainly news, something I probably would have done. So, you know, great. A peanut butter sandwich, that's all you had after 3 months of probably living at, what did you live off in the jungle, by the way? I haven't asked you that.
Well, actually, in fairness, it was a welcome relief, because we'd had basically rice and fish. And as soon as we got to the gold mining areas, we couldn't even really eat the fish properly because of the mercury that's often put in the water in order to extract the gold. So, yeah, it was a lot of rice, a lot of like freeze dried food, porridge oats. So, yeah, our diet wasn't exactly varied, shall we say.
So a peanut butter sandwich was welcomed either way. That's good.
It was delicious. Best peanut butter sandwich I've ever had.
You can't beat a peanut butter sandwich, I don't think.
No, I mean, add some a jam in there. I don't know how you feel.
Oh, yeah. PB&J. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's a good invention by the Americans there. Brilliant. Exactly. Oh, it sounds so exciting what you've done. And then when you got home, how did you feel? I mean, I've got home off incredible trips and I felt quite flat for the first few days. You know, you come back home, yeah, and the people around you haven't experienced what you've experienced. I imagine that's how it felt for you.
Yeah. And I said that this journey, one of the things that I hadn't anticipated was how much I would change. And, you know, we were living in London and I came back and I was sitting on the tube and there was just no sense of community. I was like trying to smile at people on the tube and people are like, you are the weird one. We're not going to look at you. Or, you're hitting on me. I'm not looking at you. And I found that so bizarre. And I think that coupled with being diagnosed with leishmaniasis, I was like, you know what? I want a life that's more rooted in nature and more rooted in community. So ultimately, we ended up moving out of London. We moved to a coastal seaside town called East Wittering. And yeah, it massively changed how I wanted to live my life. And now I, you know, I say good morning to my neighbours every day. I know my local community, which, and in fairness, I probably could have done that in London had I made more of an effort. But yeah, I think by that point, I was kind of done with city life. And then just going around the supermarkets and thinking, God, in order to get food in the jungle, you know, we were foraging, or the YY were like hunting, or we were fishing. And it was that kind of, yeah, just realizing how different life can be and how easy we have it and how little I'd thought about things before.
Yeah, you realize how disconnected you are from your food and where it comes from, I think.
Definitely. And I also think on that point, you know, I think there is a responsibility on the part of businesses. You look at, you know, I was in gold mines, for example, and you think, God, there is gold in so much stuff, like the laptop that we're talking in, my phone and computers and phones and stuff. We're building in this planned obsolescence, like the kind of constant like need to upgrade and all of this. And actually, I think if businesses can say, look, we're going to try and build products that will last, and I don't know, try and have more of a mindset like that. And obviously it's not necessarily going to be the most profitable, but I guess if consumers are buying more of those products,
it's such a whole other podcast episode, isn't it? Yeah. So what have you got coming up next? Any big adventures planned for the coming year now that we're all coming out of lockdown?
Although I'm not going to go down the Amazon anytime soon again, we are going to do some family trips. So we're doing a house swap in Canada.
Oh, wow.
Which will be really amazing. So we're going for a month to Whistler and hopefully get some good hikes in and some lake swims and things like that. And then in August, we're taking a motorhome and we're going across to Norway with Willow. And actually, we did that last summer in Northumberland, and it was an amazing way to travel with a toddler, because they're contained, they love it, they see new places. And it's not a kind of form of transport we've tried before. And I came to love it, actually.
I love that. That sounds great. And a house swap. You know, you're the first person I've spoken to who's done one of those. Have you done a house swap before? Is this your first time?
No. And, I can come back on and tell you if there's anything left in the house. But we got approached by some friends in our village saying, like, you know, they had some friends who were looking for a house swap, and would we be keen? And we thought, actually, why not? Because travel can be really expensive. It's kind of, you know, it feels like The Holiday, if you've seen that film.
Yes.
We were like, you know, they've got a young kid as well. You know, hopefully the houses are set up. It will hopefully save us some money. We're going to swap cars and everything. So, yeah, it's just we're trying it as a new way of traveling as a family.
That sounds amazing. I'm sure there are some logistics involved, but it sounds really cool. And like, you're living out the holiday with a child. It's great.
Exactly, the next stage, the holiday.
Yeah,
too.
Yes, exactly. There you go.
With a toddler and a baby in tow. Yeah,
you heard it here first, everybody. The holiday too. Pip, it's been absolutely fantastic talking to you. I could listen to you all day about your adventures in the Amazon, but we're going to leave it there, and I really hope you enjoy your upcoming trips.
Thank you. I hope you have fun in Peru. I'm very envious.
Thank you. I'll be coming to you for advice on insect spray. Definitely. And all of that. You know that, right?
Yeah, no, do it. DEET everywhere.
Yes, I know. And one of these people that they just seem to love as well. I don't know, you know, I don't know if it's my blood type, but they just...
Oh, juicy blood.
Yeah, that's what it is, even in this country. So yeah, I'm dreading it, but I'm sure I'll get through it anyway.
It'll be amazing.
Oh, thanks so much. You take care.
And you. Bye, Laura.